This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Purcell. On the way today, Crayons to Computers has been providing area teachers the opportunity to shop for school supplies for free for almost two decades now. This year, the demand is growing. You'll hear more later on Cincinnati Edition, and you'll learn about a new effort in Cincinnati to transform how pregnant women and infants receive health care. But first, this Friday marks the 40th anniversary of Richard Nixon's announcement that he would resign from the presidency, effective at noon on August 9th. In his new book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, John Dean, a key player in the Nixon administration, divulges the complete story of Nixon's role in Watergate, based on the former president's never-before-released secret White House recordings. John Dean and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson are here to discuss that tumultuous time in American history. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon. Mr. Dean?
Hello there.
Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Howard.
It's hard to believe it's been 40 years. I was in college at the time, and I was absolutely fascinated by this whole process. I watched everything. I listened to everything. I guess as President Nixon said, I famously was wallowing in Watergate at the time. But there are a lot of people probably listening today that who weren't born at the time or were too young to understand what was going on. Could you just briefly kind of put this in historical perspective for us?
Sure. Actually, my audience for this book was both those who lived through it, who undoubtedly have questions, because I certainly did, as well as those who are totally unaware of it. Broadly defined, Watergate begins with a bungled burglary on June 7th, or the arrest of, after the bungled burglary, on June 17th of 1972. It will morph into a dictionary definition of abuse of political power and presidential power during the presidency of Richard Nixon, and it includes everything from black bag jobs to electronic surveillance, dirty tricks in campaigns, all the things that surfaced during Watergate and the subsequent hearings. So it's a sorry chapter and a black mark on American politics, and for a while certainly left the country a little wiser and a lot more careful.
And we all know, and there were a whole lot of people who were losing faith in the presidency itself at that point.
Well, there were. The war in Vietnam had actually, if you chart the public opinion polls, a much more severe repercussion for American public opinion than did Watergate. Kind of gave that a boost. But then it came back. It would return during subsequent presidencies. When Ford took over, it started back up. When Carter followed Ford and Reagan followed Ford, they started a return. And by the time Clinton's in there, you've got a pretty healthy respect again for the presidents.
In putting together this book, you transcribed over 1,000 of the conversations that were secretly taped at the White House, and astonishingly, there were like over 600 of them that had never been heard before.
What I set out to do was to try to understand how somebody as savvy as Richard Nixon could really make the mistakes he made that would result in a bungled burglary blowing up and imploding his presidency. And I knew that the answer to those questions would be on some of the recordings, self-secret recordings that Nixon had made that had not been transcribed. And slowly but surely they've been coming out over the years. So the first thing I discovered is nobody cataloged them. And I found by going through the subject logs that the archives have prepared, and bless them for it because they do a wonderful job, and I actually dedicate the book to them because they're they're sort of the unsung heroes of this bit of history, keeping it in processing and preserving it, because they have to go through these conversations to extract any national security information, any personal information, and then when that personal information, for example, is no longer a problem because the people are deceased, they tend to put it back in. So that filled in some gaps. Anyway, long story short, I found about 400 transcripts had been prepared of various conversations by the Watergate prosecutor and a historian, Stanley Cutler, but they were all partial transcripts. And huge gaps left out for various reasons. One for Cutler, because he was compressing, because he was doing transcripts. But then I found another 600 conversations that appeared nobody had ever even attempted to transcribe. Mm-hmm. So, these conversations can run from, you know, a couple minutes to many hours, particularly as Nixon became more consumed by it. They get quite lengthy.
And were these throughout this entire period, I mean, after the break-in, all the way through to,
well,
to the end?
As the pattern emerges in the book, part one, which is the formation of the cover-up, has roughly 35 to 36 or 7 conversations are involved there. And I do that, I spread those out there so the people, after following an epilogue, can get familiar with the characters and how this cover-up was formed, and the fact that Nixon is really in it from the just from the outset, no question. And then the next two parts, it gets a little bit more compressed, but actually parts 1, 2, and 3 are only 300 conversations. Part 4 is almost 700 conversations. And that's where they're all consuming at that point.
You came to the conclusion, obviously, that President Nixon did not order the break-in of Democratic headquarters at the Watergate complex, correct?
That's correct. It's clear from the evidence he did not.
Yeah, but it was very soon thereafter that he was informed of what was going on.
Yes.
And you believe from that point on he was...
What's surprising, Howard, is that he asked initially to not be told. Then he gets curious and starts asking questions. And Haldeman and later Ehrlichman dissemble. They don't tell him that factually what's going on. They don't give him information that he needs to know. And if he doesn't even have the information to make some of the decisions he might have wanted to make, but he doesn't have that option because he has less than full information. And he discovers that much later, that they have not been totally candid with him.
Do you feel like, I mean, and I've always wondered this about this, you know, okay, he did not order this, but do you feel like he created an atmosphere in which people, his subordinates, felt that this was what he would want?
Absolutely. And what's ironic is the night that the arrests occur at the Watergate, that was not the primary mission for that night. That was just a stop-by to fix the bungled earlier attempt where they had tried to go into Larry O'Brien's office and hadn't even found Larry O'Brien's office to place a bug. And the bug that they placed wasn't working. They get arrested, however, when they're there, and they just decided to take some more pictures of financial information, because that's what originally they were looking for, something to just embarrass the Democrats with. But what their real mission the night of the 17th was is actually traceable right back to Richard Nixon. Let me explain that to you. They were going to go to they were planning to go to McGovern's office. McGovern was the senator who was running against Richard Nixon in 72. What happened is Nixon had issued an order, and it's on the tapes, telling in a conversation with Haldeman, saying, let's put a plant, not a flower, but like somebody like a secretary or a chauffeur or
sure.
something like that in McGovern's office. But Liddy would have obviously could have interpreted that plant to be an electronic device. Anyway, what Haldeman does is he doesn't explain all that when he passes it on to his aide. He tells Gordon Strawn to get a hold of Liddy, to tell Liddy to transfer his intelligence gathering operation from Muskie, who had been the front runner, to McGovern. Mm-hmm. So Liddy is literally asked to come over to the White House. Strawn reads him that instruction. Liddy salutes, leaves, and this is their agenda for that night. And had they have been arrested in McGovern's headquarters, you got a problem tracing right back to the White House, right back to the president.
And earlier, there had been a dirty tricks operation aimed at Ed Muskie, who was the original front runner in that election.
Yes, there had been. They had a plant in there, and again, not a flower. Maybe it was a flower with something that had ears.
Have you answered the question for yourself that you raised earlier about, you know, how somebody is intelligent?
And one of the answers is that Richard Nixon was not as savvy as I thought he was. That becomes evident to the reader as you follow this. What I found was a much more dramatic story than I had anticipated. I try to just stay out of it, and I draw the narrative and dialogue from the tapes. I have roughly 21 3-inch notebooks filled with tapes. That's about 8,500 pages. That translates into about 4 million words of transcribed conversations. And I boil that down to 635 pages of narrative. The rest is notes and endnotes and indexes and what have you. And that was the challenge. I'm not sure which was harder, was transcribing them or turning around and then boiling them back down.
Clearly, this man had some serious character defects. And
there's serious character problems. I Watergate should be viewed as something of a nonpartisan handle for understanding purposes. And I say that for this reason. 80%, a clear 80%, in the most probably right-leaning poll, the Gallup poll, and it's higher in some of the other polls, but let's just say 80% of the American people totally endorsed Nixon's resignation as the right way to resolve Watergate. Where can you find 80% of Americans agreeing about anything?
Yeah. And that was clearly the case at the time.
For that reason alone, I think we should understand this scandal, because if that many people agree that it should be ended, then we ought to at least understand it so it doesn't happen again. We tend to be a country that likes to ignore history so we can repeat it.
I remember seeing a PBS documentary on Nixon, Elliot Richardson, the attorney general, who quit rather than fire the special prosecutor Archibald Cox, talked about these character flaws of Nixon's, the paranoia, the desire to get back at his enemies, the paranoia, and he basically
so you can
said
see some of that in this book. And as it turns out, his final defense is to attack me, because I decided, when I broke rank, I was very open about it, and I told him what I was doing, why I was doing it, and I just didn't agree with, you know, an ongoing cover-up. A lot of people think that's wrong, that I should have gone on with the cover-up, but it isn't a life I could have lived. You know, I just couldn't live with myself. Well, and one of Nixon's former speechwriters said, well, the solution was I should have gone in a room with a gun.
You know, I mean, 40 years later, and obviously, you know, you were in the beginning of this thing. You had a reduced prison sentence because you cooperated with prosecutors on this, and your testimony before the Senate Watergate Committee.
Actually, the government couldn't have prosecuted me if I hadn't have pled.
Is that right? Yeah. But, I mean, how do you feel about this now from a personal standpoint?
Well, you know, I tried to be as objective in reporting this as I could be, because I honestly wanted to understand it and write it the way it really is. And I didn't try to spin it one way or the other. In fact, there are a lot of facts in there I report that come up that are things I just soon not have had made public, even though I'm the one who discovered them. But I said, you know, I'll be criticized if I don't. And there's an appendix C on this where anyone who wants to listen to these conversations can go listen to them. My transcripts, I haven't decided what I'm going to do with them yet. During the process, I printed them all out, and I often made extensive notes on them as I re-listened to some of the work of my transcribers. And then I found some other places where even later than they had transcribed, the archives had reinserted material. So it would take me 6 months or more to get those transcripts into a publishable form. And frankly, I just can't do it at this point. I've been on this 4 years. I need a break from it.
The name of the book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, by John W. Dean. Mr. Dean, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson talking with former presidential counsel John Dean about his new book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. Available where books are sold. You can learn more about the book at WVXU.org.